Podcasting from the beautiful Mile High City, you're listening to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no-holds-barred, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. Here's your host, Jake Shannon.
Tuning in, this is the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the leader in no holds barred catches catch can wrestling. I am your host, Jake Shannon, and I am absolutely thrilled. This is like the coolest gig for me because I get to talk to these guys that are really have influenced my thinking or that I've trained with. You know, I mean, you guys know if you've listened to the podcast. Today I got a guy that early on I was really referencing a lot of his research, Scott Teal. Scott Teal is an author. So I've had Mark Fleming on. Scott Teal helped write his book, It's Wrestling, Not Wrestling. And he just released another amazing book called The Annotated Fall Guys, The Barnums of Bounce. Anyway, that's a classic book, and yeah, I highly recommend it. I've been digging into it deep. Scott is also the publisher at Crowbar Press. Go over there. Tons of great wrestling history. Crowbarpress.com. And he's also a vice president over at the Cauliflower Alley Club, which I'm a lifetime member. If you're not, I definitely, you get over there, cauliflowerallyclub.org. So without any further ado, I want to bring in Scott. Are you there, Scott?
I'm here. Hey, glad to be here, Jake. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, this is going to be a real pleasure. So first of all, how the hell was Cauliflower Alley? I have not gone. You know, I had kids in 2007, and that's pretty much when I stopped going. So I'm hoping now that they're like 12 years old, I should be able to get out again. How was this last one?
Oh, it was great. Everything went so well. We sort of fine-tuned a lot of things, and we got the registration down, and we were worried about that. Cause we sort of had a turnover on the board of directors, and I came on board, and we've revamped the what we call the gathering room, the room where all the vendors are and everybody just sort of gathers and visits. We revamped that, and everything went real well. I was just very, very pleased, and everybody, we've had really no complaints. We've had several, you know, suggestions of things that we could improve next year, but it was my first year going in, and I was sort of just hit the ground running with nobody really to clue me in on what to do, and I just sort of did work things as best I could, and it all worked out. We had a really good time. You'll have to go next year for sure.
I'm going to go. I mean, I got to tell a couple of Cauliflower Alley stories. First of all, this is just ridiculous. What a wrestling nerd that I am. So I got married in 2006 in Vegas. My wife and I went to the Graceland Chapel, which is an Elvis impersonator, like, marries you. We eloped, and then that was in the morning, and then in the afternoon, my wife and I were out there slinging DVDs and books for Scientific Wrestling at the Cauliflower Alley reunion, and then that night, this is what a trooper my wife is, and then that night, I was able to give the Cauliflower Alley, I don't know if you guys still do it, but there was a martial arts award, and one of my friends, Mike Martel, was given the award, and I was able to co-present with Gene LaBelle, which was just such a fantastic day for me, selfishly, to get married to the love of my life, the mother of my children, and then go and hang out at Cauliflower Alley all day long. I really love that organization. Did you guys have... I know that, like, after I stopped going, I don't know that there's any causal relationship there, but you guys started getting like all kinds of, I think the last year we went, Steve Austin was there and a few other big names. I think Mil Mascaris was there and a couple others. Did you have any big celebrities there this year?
Not that I know of, not celebrity. I mean, other than, you know, we had Mark Henry, of course, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I guess Tyrus, he was there. Ooh, I'm trying to think who else was on the roster there. Of course, the new NWBA World Heavyweight Champion, Nick Aldis.
Nice.
I don't know what kind of shoot guys were there. I didn't. Dan Severn, he was there last year, but he wasn't there this year. But I don't know how many, if we had any guys, you'll sort of fall into your realm there, the shoot type guys.
Yeah, I met Severn there. That was the first place I met Severn. I also met Benoit, and I also met, who else? Oh, Danny Hodge, I first met at a conference. It's like such an amazing resource. There.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, I was there when Red Bastien was in charge, and he was, man, he really took me under my wing, under his wing. He was such a great guy, and Nick Bockwinkel, too. They were both just so generous and so helpful to, like, you know, yes. Young guys like me.
They're, you know, both of those guys were big, big stars, and one of the things I tell people all the time about pro wrestling, it's one of the few sports, professional sports, where you can go to things like Cauliflower Alley Club, the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, some of the reunions, and actually rub shoulders with these guys, and they sit and talk to you just like you were long-lost friends. You know, I mean, where can you go in professional football and sit down with guys and just have one-on-ones with these guys? And it's not just situations where, you know, you pay $50 to get their autograph and a photo, but you go in there and these guys actually sit down with you and they'll talk to you, sit in the lobby and just, you know, shoot the bull with you. I can't think of any professional sport in which guys really do that, not to the level that pro wrestling does.
Well, it's nice because Cauliflower Alley, it's not like one of these, Comic-Con or, wrestling convention Fantastic. Things. Yeah, it's more like a fraternal organization,
Yes.
Or at least that's a vibe.
We picked up a lot more fans, and it used to be pretty much just the boys and not geared so much to the fans, but out of necessity, the fans are so, the boys love the fans. In the past, they sort of shied away from the fans. Of course, a lot of that was due to kayfabe, and they didn't want to, open up to the fans. And that went on, well into the early 2000s. I talked to guys that opened up with me back in the mid-1990s for my shoot interviews for my Whatever Happened To magazine.
Yeah.
That they opened up with me, but it's only because I traveled with them and I was in the business with them. But a lot of guys wouldn't. I mean, it was until year 2000 or after. There were some guys just still absolutely had a hard time talking to the boys. And that's sort of why it was more just the boys back then. But with everything, has come out in the open, and even the hardcore guys today are realizing, there's no secrets anymore. Everything's been written about and discussed, and the fans are just as smart as the boys were anymore. So it's, it's much more open, and we do have a lot of fans. The trouble with right now, I tell everybody, get to these reunions and even the fan fests and Cauliflower Alley Club, things like that, because another 5-10 years, all the guys that we think of as being really the legends, they're going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the 50s guys are now, there's only a handful really left of the big names. And some of them I've sort of even lost track of. I'm not real, some of them I've heard rumors they passed away, but I don't know for sure. But that's why it's so important these days to get out to these things and talk to these guys while you can, because they're our only source of real material from the old days. Somebody was telling me the other day they're going to write a book about I forget who it was, some wrestler who is dead. And I said, I think that's great. I said, but I want to interview as many of these guys that are still alive as I can before they're gone, because these are the guys, they have firsthand knowledge of these stories. And I'd rather get it directly from the horse's mouth, So, but yeah, I encourage everybody to get out to these things and go to the Cauliflower Alley Club next year in Vegas. It's not expensive at all. And you'll have a great time just standing around talking and meeting other fans. I have a great time every year, and I love having my table with my books, not to sell books, but because everybody stops at the table.
Yeah.
I have met and talked to so many of the fans by having that table, because everybody comes to the table. Whereas if you're just walking around, there's going to be people you're not even going to see. But everybody comes by the table, so I love having a table there. And I sit in every year. I look forward to seeing both the wrestlers and the fans.
You know, you bring up an interesting point, because exactly what you said in terms of talking to these guys and getting it from the horse's mouth, as they say. I mean, really, that's what I did with Scientific Wrestling, except I took I took a little different angle, where I'm like, man, teach me these freaking moves, man. Like, because when you're gone, that's it. Like, nobody's going to know how to think about wrestling this way anymore. So, I mean, I get that 100%. And, you know, you talk about these guys passing away. I mean, it had to be a bit of a interesting reunion with Dick Beyer not being there for the first time.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it was sad. It really was sad, because Dick was always there. He was always in the, you know, in the memorabilia room there, what we call the gathering room now. He was always there. He's always willing to talk. He talked to everybody, you know. It's like I said a while ago. These guys were huge, huge names in business, but they come right down to earth and talk to fans just like they would their peers, you know, and treat them just as they would family. In fact, they make you feel like family. And Dick's absence this year was felt by all of us.
Well, I remember
one interesting thing that I like to point out. Dick Beyer was really the one who started out the cribbage tournament.
Yeah,
several years ago, and amazingly enough, his son won the tournament this year. It wasn't a work. A lot of people laughed and they said, oh, yeah, it's probably a work. He actually won the tournament. And we honored Dick at the banquet, and we had his son come up and accept the award. And I thought it was couldn't have been any more perfect, you know, to have his son win the cribbage tournament. And right as soon as we present him his award, we honor Dick with a short video and a short talk about him. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that's funny. That, I mean, yeah, I could definitely see how people be calling to work on that. I remember when Dick, the last reunion I attended back in 2006, I remember Dick it could be fuzzy a little bit, cause it's been a dozen years or however many, but, Mil Mascaris was there being honored as well that year. And I remember him and Dick getting up on the podium there and talking about their match. And they're like, that was about the closest to a shoot match we've ever had. And, you know, Dick was a tough guy, and so is Mil Mascaris. So, you know, I went and I looked that up later on the internet. It's a great match. And speaking of shooters, the last table I had at Cauliflower Alley back then was sitting, and this was before he passed away, it was before Dr. Death. I was sitting next to Dr. Death. So I got to meet him and got to know him pretty well, and then, unfortunately passed away. But it's a great place.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody has fun. We had a couple people there this year that really had no tie to wrestling other than their fathers were pro wrestlers, and their fathers, just one of them, Alexis Smirnoff's daughter was there.
Oh, wow.
She doesn't seem to know a lot about wrestling, but she came back again this year. We honored her father last year. She came back this year, and I always wonder, you know, with things like that, they don't know much about wrestling, whether they'll feel comfortable. And she had a great time. She said she just felt so welcome. And another girl, Gail Palmer, was there. Her father was the great Walter Palmer, who was a big name in Chicago back in the 50s. And she, same way, she told me at the end of the reunion, she said, I have had so much fun. And I worried about it the whole time, because I kept thinking, you know, she doesn't really know anybody. She doesn't know much about wrestling, so, you know, is she really going to feel comfortable and feel at home here at the reunion? But she had a great time. So that makes me feel like some way the Cauliflower Alley is doing something right.
Well, I remember your whatever happened to, I mean, that and Meltzer in the 90s before the internet, I mean, that was like that was my source, you know, like that was like my education. So I have so many back issues. I have like, oh man, it's unbelievable. I mean, anyway, so Crowbar Press, I mean, Jesus, man, how many books have you written?
Well, I, with Cauliflower Alley Club, I premiered four new books, and since I got home, I've been trying to catch up with things to do, but I finished another one just yesterday, sent it in. It's a book, I don't know if you've read the Breaking Kayfabe book by Jeff Bowdrin.
No.
But back in the back in 1990, he published a he had a regular feature column in the Observer. It's the longest running column, really the only regular column ever featured in the Observer. And it was called Bowdrin the Booker. And what he did was he would write as if he was the booker for Ted Turner and WDBS, and he was booking WCW the way it should be booking, because at the time they were doing the most ridiculous stuff. And he presented, it was almost like an alternative universe. And I just finished the edit on that yesterday. The layout sent it in. I'll have those for Fan Fest. We're having a Fan Fest in Tampa, Florida in June, middle of June. And
nice.
I'll have it premiere there. And I'm currently working on a little fiction book that from 1954 called The Mighty Milo by a guy named Philip Rogers. I can't find a lot about Rogers. Apparently that's a pen name. Online they say I can't remember what the name of the guy is, but they say it was some other guy who used to be a boxer who wrote it, but I don't believe it, because that guy wrote some other books that were just phenomenal. And in The Mighty Milo, well, it's written okay. There's a lot of little things about his writing that just does not match somebody that was really a world-class author. And so I really can't figure out, but anyway, I'm doing a reprint of that book. I'm hoping to have that done. I may have that ready for Tampa Fan Fest as well. But I've written 37 total books. You can say written, because just about every book I've gotten, I've rewritten, except like, you know, the Alabama book I just came out with Jason Presley. I did, you know, I always check everything and research everything behind them to be sure things are correct. And but I've got right now about 12 other projects on the board that some are halfway done, some are almost done, some are, you know, I'm just getting into them. But by the end of the year, I should have another probably five or six books ready.
Wow, that is just amazing. I mean, I'm just speaking as an author myself. I mean, prolific is like the only word I can really muster, because I've written a couple, and they take a crap ton of time. and the level of research that you do and the knowledge that you share is amazing. I mean,
thank you.
As an author where your primary focus is pro wrestling, I mean, I always liken it to like trying to do, you know, like the history of spies or of espionage or something, because you never know what is fucking real or not. Like, it's like, you know, is this kayfabe or is this like a legit thing? Or, you know, does the news, like a lot of people use newspaper clippings, but then the newspapers were either in on it or ignorant to some of the ways the business worked. So, yeah. You know, it's so important to get those primary sources, those original old timers, and see if you could corroborate their stories, you know?
Yeah, the newspapers for the most part. I mean, there was some newspapers in on it, you know, the promoters. Promoters, in a lot of cases, they actually paid. Not only did they pay by advertising space, the box ads that we all love so much, but they also paid for, you know, for the reporters to come out and cover the matches. And the reporters, for the most part, you know, they wrote just straight storyline, what happened in the matches, who beat who, how they did it, you know, some of the highlights. But very few of them were actually smart to the business. There were some, you know, now and then that were, but most of the cases, like you say, you have to be really careful when researching. Sadly, a lot of our research has to be done by newspaper, because that's the only source we have left. But a lot of the newspapers, they get the results wrong, incorrect. They, you know, they report that they misspell names terribly. Oh my goodness, that's the biggest problem, even in the ads. And that's of course that in part is due to the promoters. Either they couldn't read the promoter's scribbling, or the promoter just didn't know how to spell either, you know. So yeah, there was a lot of problem with newspapers. You really have to be careful, you know, with what you believe to be true. And unfortunately, as I say, there's so few places now to go and corroborate those stories and to be sure that they are factual.
Well, one of the things that I find, where you have a broader application outside of wrestling is when you start doing the research into this, you start looking. I mean, you realize all this Trump hullabaloo about fake news, that's not new. That's been going on forever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And funny you mentioned about doing other things like History of Spies, and there's been times I think, you know what, I ought to try and maybe write a book about football, do a biography with some big football player, or a soccer player, a basketball star or something, but I just cannot. Wrestling's my thing. I love doing it, and I just can't imagine writing about anything else. Now, if I was in a position that I needed the money, you know this probably as well as I do. If you need money and you want to make a living doing something making money, you don't write about wrestling. You don't produce DVDs about wrestling.
Truth. That is the truth.
Yes, it's a labor of love. You've got a ton of DVDs. Great. I mean, just fantastic stuff on shoots, and pinning and all the different areas of actual real wrestling. But, when you get, could you do that for a living?
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
It's a labor of love. It's what we fell in love with back however many years ago. I fell in love with it in 1968. And I mean, from the first time I laid eyes on pro wrestling. And it's what I want to write about. And I'm fortunate that I don't have to, I'm retired now. I've got a good pension. I don't have to worry about it. Even when I was working, I didn't worry about it. I write books based on the story and how interesting a story it is, and how much we can record about the pro wrestling history. That's what's important to me. I've written books with guys. One guy I wrote a book with, his biggest claim to fame. Now, this is his biggest claim to fame, was wrestling one television show for Vern Gagne. One match for Vern Gagne. Everything else was little tiny tank town independent shows.
Yeah.
All through Indiana and Michigan, there was times he'd make $5. There's times he'd get paid, they say your pay, you go to the concession stand, get as many hot dogs as you want, it's just not, he's not a guy that would sell a lot of books, but to me, his story was so interesting. I thought, this story needs to be in print. So I published it. And it took me 2 years just to get my investment back from the number of books I ordered.
Wow.
And I got it back eventually. But it's not about the money. If you're, like I said, if it's about the money, and that's what I tell all the guys that call me, if a wrestler calls us, hey, I really want you to help, I need somebody to help me write my book. I tell them, I say, well, first of all, I got to know this. I say, if you're writing a book because you want to make money, then I don't even start.
Yep.
Don't even begin.
Yep.
I said, but if you want to do it to preserve your legacy for your family, for future generations, and you just like your story told so that everybody will have it one day, I said, by all means, let's get started. But if it's about money, don't even think about it.
No,
you won't make any.
That is the truth, man. I mean, because it's so funny you say that, because I have the same problem. I have so many guys that like hit me up. They're like, I want to do an instructional video, or I want to do seminars. And I'm like, man, okay. This is small. I mean, the fans are rabid. They're very, very like devoted and loyal fans, but man, there's not that many. And, I tried to run, we ran a test show last year to do a catch wrestling promotion. And I think we had 50 people in the building. I mean, it was a massive,
wow.
It was a massive loss. So,
right.
Just the market is, it's a very small market. And, guys like you, guys like me, we try to polish it up, make it look super professional, and I think that maybe
right.
Gives a bit of an illusion that there's a bigger scene than what there really is. It's that there's a hardcore scene is what I find. They're just super hardcore.
Right. Absolutely. And especially the area that I write about, it's stuff the 40s, 50s. In fact, Great Wrestling Venue series, like Madison Square Garden, Nashville, all those series I'm doing now, that stuff goes back into the 20s and before the 20s and all the way up 50s and 60s. And the fans for that kind of material, they're dying just as fast as the old-time wrestlers are. So, there aren't that many younger people that are picking up. There are some. I mean, I talk to some 20-year-olds. They say, I love this stuff from the 40s and 50s, some of those old matches, and I love reading about it. God bless them, you know, but they're just a dime a dozen. There aren't that many of them.
Well, they're probably the wrestlers reincarnated just wanting to read their own stories.
Could be.
Because I'm telling you, it's small. So we're coming up on our first break here. I do, after the commercial break, we got to keep the lights on, pay for the lights and stuff. But I want to talk to you a little bit. I want to talk about a bunch of things, but I want to talk about this book, The Annotated Fall Guys, The Barnums Abounds, because the addition of The Annotated, and this is you and Steve Yoey put it together. I mean, it's real. This is like, man, I mean, this is almost like a PhD level research. It's amazing. Like, as you read it, because that book, The Fall Guys, was such a seminal book for all the people in terms of the historical narrative of pro wrestling. And boy, you guys really kind of, I don't say you pick it apart so much as you really just set the record straight. And it's absolutely fascinating. So I kind of want to talk about the book, but I also want to talk about the business, because I think a lot of people, especially the people that I deal with in this catch wrestling fan base and practitioners and stuff, I think there's some things that need to be set straight about the business, because I think a lot of people were trying to sell DVDs and whatever and sell an ad copy and not true history about what really catch wrestling is about. So let's come back after the break here. Guys, I got Scott Teal, author of Fall Guys, publisher at Crowbar Press, and vice president over at the Cauliflower Alley. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Come on right back. Okay, so I'm really excited today. We've got Scott Teal with us. Scott is just one hell of a wrestling historian. He's very involved on the historical research side. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who is more involved. I mean, there's like a handful, probably people you could count on one hand. So, Scott, how did this come about? I know that. I read in the intro you said that Steve Yoey, who also helped you do the the Do It Again podcast. I've got a wonderful guest, Scott Teal. He is a author. He is a publisher. You can go check out his prolific works at crowbarpress.com. He's also a vice president at the Cauliflower Alley Club. I'm really excited to have him. Scott, are you still with us?
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. We've been having some crazy technical difficulties, so I thank you for your patience.
I love your Do It Again podcast. That made me laugh out loud.
Well, Billy used to, I got that. I even got it tattooed on my arm trying to get it out of my head. Billy's old gruff voice telling us to do it over and over again for the thousandth time. So this book, The Fall Guys, is really a unique book because, you could correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not sure if it's the first, but it's kind of like the first big expose, or I don't know how you'd say it, of what the business actually was. Like, you know, I think people had an idea that it was a little fishy in terms of like the predetermined outcomes and stuff, but nobody was really explicitly saying that until Griffin came about. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there wrestling back in the late 1800s. I guess the earliest clipping I found is 1887. I know Jimmy Wheeler on Professional Wrestling Historical Society on Facebook. He's found them even before that, but there is one article after another from the 1800s all the way up that say wrestling fake, wrestling fake, wrestling fake. It just one after another. But the Fall Guys was really the first actual book that talked about pro wrestling in a manner in which it wasn't all straight and on the up and up. It was really way ahead of its time. And I when I first read it, I was absolutely amazed because I kept thinking, well, why didn't they kill this guy? You know, to me, I mean, because when I was in the business in the 70s, You know, you didn't talk. You didn't tell your fan, the fans. Most of the boys didn't even tell their wives. They didn't smarten their wives up as far as their wives knew. I'm sure their wives knew, you know, but still you didn't wise your family up and tell them anything different than it's all real. And for the Fall Guys to come out in a time when none of that was shared with the public was really, really pretty awesome, you know, for the real wrestling fans. And that's what I've discovered when I found the book. It blew me away. I thought, I can't believe this stuff is in print. And I never knew this stuff. I learned so much about the business, you know, from the book itself.
So you originally started reading this in the early 70s, isn't that right?
Yeah, I'd say around 1970, probably 71, maybe. I don't think it was late. It had to be at least 1970, 71. And I had it around, I bet I've read it two or three times up until around 2002, 2003. And I had read a couple books, the annotated Tarzan of the Apes and the annotated Wizard of Oz. I didn't know what annotated meant until I picked up those two books. I was a big fan of Wizard of Oz, a big fan of Tarzan of the Apes, Edgar Rice Burroughs books. And I was fascinated because both those books, that they presented the book as it was originally printed, but on the left-hand side of the page, the editor or the author of the annotated version, he gave his comments about the book, The Wizard of Oz, things that happened behind the scenes during Frank L. Baum's life as he wrote The Wizard of Oz, you know, things about his life, maybe some of the characters may be based on people that Frank Baum knew or family members. Same with Edgar Rice Burroughs, the guy that wrote the annotated version of Tarzan of the Apes presented it as if all the people in Tarzan of the Apes book were based on real characters that Edgar Rice Burroughs knew, and that it was Tarzan the Apes was an actual person. And it made a lot of sense. And of course, me being I guess I probably was about 14 years old when I read it, I believed every word of it. Of course, you know, I'm sure it was all fictionalized, but he made it sounded so real. And this guy was supposedly doing all this research. But anyways, all that aside, in about 2003 or 4, I had the idea to do the annotated Fall Guys because I had come to the realization that Fall Guys was filled with lies and inconsistencies and all kinds of errors. And I contacted a bunch of historians. I said, why don't we do a team effort on this? And I sent everybody a copy of the book. And I said, just anytime you see, read the book and between paragraphs, write your thoughts on and things that you know aren't true or things that you like that should be cleared up. And out of about 10 people I sent it to, I really only got submissions back from two. And one of them, Steve Yowie, is the only one really sent very much of substance. And so I sort of put the thing aside because I didn't get much response. And I picked it up two or three times and got with Steve and over the years. And Steve, in the meantime, had been writing about it online on message boards and Facebook group, or I don't know about Facebook, but different message boards. And he'd been writing about Fall Guys and all these things that we talk about in the book. And about a year and a half ago, I contacted Steve. I said, Steve, let's do the Fall Guys. Let's get it done. Let's do what we plan to do, only let's just you and I do it. You and I are the ones that are going to make it happen. I don't want to have to be chasing everybody to get the information we need. So Steve, was reluctant. He said he had talked about it so much, he figured people were sick and tired of him talking about it. And but I said, no. I said, Steve, this could be one of the, well, first of all, Fall Guys, to me, was for a long, long time, for decades, was the most important book ever written about pro wrestling.
I think that was how most people felt, right? Because yeah, it was the first one to really, quote unquote, expose the business, as you say. Like it was the first one to really say, "Hey, guys, no, here's all the backstory dirt," and it's pretty clever because as you guys make the case that, you know, this is not a historical book. This is really a book, a marketing book to put over Toots Mont.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I told Steve, I said, the Fall Guys, I keep calling it the Fall Guys. It's not the Fall Guys. It's the Fall Guys.
Fall Guys, yeah.
I told Steve, I said, Fall Guys is probably the most important book, and people still look at it as the most important book ever written about pro wrestling, especially for that era, because nothing else has ever really been written about that era in such depth. I said, in my opinion, if we come out with the annotated Fall Guys and we lay to rest all the problems with the book and go into more detail about what Marcus Griffin was talking about, I said, in my opinion, it will be the most important book ever written about pro wrestling, period.
Yeah.
Because there is so much in it from that era. Really, it was the era when pro wrestling as we know it, not so much as we know it, well, yeah, as we know it today, actually got started, you know, with all the more showmanship. Hey, that's, you know, wrestling's been, had showmanship back into the, you know, 1800s, but not to the level it did when Toots Mont took over. And Toots Mont's really the one that started the ideas of program, you know, working programs, a series of matches to build to a big climax match, you know, angles to, you know, to get people to come back week after week. He's really the one that really started to push that kind of, that kind of thing. So, so that's why the book was so important, and I, why I think what we've done is even more so important, because we add so much detail to what Marcus Griffin already added, but we add it in such a way that it's pretty, you know, it's factual as far as we know.
Well, what's interesting is, I'm sorry because, you know, I just see parallels so many with politics. And it's really clever because, right, like we see all this stuff with like WikiLeaks and all these exposés in espionage and all that kind of stuff, right? Like us average Joes who just sit around consuming news. And it's very interesting in that whole field. There's this idea of like a controlled leak where, oh, well, if the information's going to get out, well, why don't we present it and then we could put our spin, our public relations group on it, so we could spin it our way, which is kind of what it seems like Griffin was doing on behalf of Mont.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. Yeah. You wouldn't have known it, though, for, like I said, for decades. Most of us thought it was, you know, like I said, the Bible of professional wrestling. We thought everything in it was straight down the aisle.
But you started noticing like a lot of cracks, like, ah, okay, he keeps making mistakes, and then eventually you realize these aren't mistakes, these are willful.
Yeah, it all started really when I began noticing things like, or Steve, really, Steve, I would say Steve tumbled onto it before I did, because he was writing about it, and I guess thinking back, I probably was reading what he was writing, and so I started looking myself, and I sort of noticed some of the dates weren't right, and I thought, oh, wait a minute. So I started researching the dates and found a few, some of them were incorrect, so as I corrected those, then I noticed the things he said about the matches. I would go back in the newspaper archives, say to 1930 or 1920, and I'd read about a match held in Comiskey Ballpark. I think that's where the one was, and Griffin had written that the matches that night, the match was so bad, he was trying to put Jim Londis down. He says the match was so bad that the fans rioted, and well, there was nothing like that ever happened. All the newspapers that covered it, not one of them mentioned anything about a riot. In fact, one newspaper said, it may have said something about the fans weren't happy, but they filed out orderly and civilly and left the ballpark after the last match. You know, so nothing of the sort happened. And those were the kind of things that made me think, you know, if he's got these things wrong, you know, what else is there? And as I began to research farther, and actually Steve began to research more farther at that time, we began to realize, you know, it wasn't just mistakes. It was just blatant lies to feed the narrative like Griffin and Toots Mont wanted people to think.
So it was really promotional material presented as historical or journalistic material.
Yes. Oh, yes. And even today, you know, you talk to wrestlers today. I've interviewed hundreds of wrestlers, and so many of them, some of them, you know, they try to put themselves over by telling you things. And there's a lot of things. I don't know if it's true or not, because it's their story.
Yeah.
But there are things that I do know aren't true. you know, for one, Joe, Bill Bowman and Joe Turner. And I love these guys to death, and they weren't lying to me. But they told me so many times, I heard them tell me and other people, they wrestled here in Tennessee as Joe and Bill Sky. Well, yes, they did. That's true. And I heard them so many times say, yeah, we did so well there. We were in the main event. He says, we wrestled there for over a year as Bill and Joe Sky. They were here for like 2 months. But in their minds, they weren't lying. In their minds, and you've probably noticed this yourself, you know, you tell a story on the way you remember it. We don't always, you know, there's things that influence the way we remember stories.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I mean, I'm a big fan of, there's this group out there, you might have heard of them called, it's political, but they're called the Innocence Project. And, you know, they're tasked with getting innocent people that are either on death row or have life sentences, getting them out, you know? What they found is that, you know, a lot of these guys are getting cleared with DNA evidence, but they were put away with eyewitness testimony. That doesn't mean that the eyewitness was lying. No, it just means, man, memory and perception and things like that are super duper faulty.
Yes.
So absolutely. It doesn't mean they're necessarily like bad guys out there lying. It's just their memory is not really accurate.
Absolutely. And it changes over time too. You know, you know a story, you know, in a certain way. And over time, it's, for some reason, your brain, I don't know if it's short circuits in our brain or what it is, but, you know, stories, the way things actually happen change, and we believe, because I've had, you know, I've told stories, and then, you know, like when we're with my mother, I'll tell a story about she'll say, well, no, you remember what, we did this that night, and all of a sudden, when she says that, it kicks that in.
Yeah.
You're right, and I remember telling her, I said, you know what, I've been telling that story the way I've been telling it, writing it, I just told it, for years, and I had forgotten all about that part, and now I realize all those years I've been telling the story incorrectly. But the difference is, we're doing it not because of any agenda like Marcus Griffin had. We're doing
right.
It because that's the way we remember it. Marcus Griffin was flat out lying.
It's like you were saying, like, so back then, those guys were making a lot of money, and there, you know, I mean, this was clearly a marketing campaign or a PR or a propaganda, whatever you want to call it. But you know, guys like you and me, we do this out of passion. There's not really any money in it. We're just trying to figure stuff out as best we can and present it so people can make their own judgments. And I mean, you guys have done truly an amazing job. I really enjoyed, I really recommend everybody go get a copy of, the Annotated Fall Guys. It's amazing. Go to crowbarpress.com. The other book that I really enjoyed that you helped put together was Mark Fleming's book. It's Wrestling, Not Wrestling. That was a really great book.
Thank you. Mark's a great guy. He called me and wanted to know if I wanted to write his story. And he's one of those that I was unsure of because I didn't know a lot about Mark. I was good friends with Lou Fez, Mark's mentor. And mm-hmm. So I knew of Mark, and I knew the respect that Lou Thesz had for Mark. So that made me – that really turned the tip, as they used to say, to actually do Mark's book because I didn't know – Mark's more of a modern guy, you know. I'm not modern, but the 80s. And my real interest in pro wrestling, it sort of ends with 1982, 80, 81.
Yeah.
Even though I've written books with guys, you know, later. But I like the older stuff, but – when I got talking with Mark and he sent me, you know, a rough draft of his manuscript, and I thought, yeah, this is a good story. I like this. It was really interesting. Same way with Downtown Bruno, you know, Bruno manager, skinny little runt that had a great career as a manager, and he still works for WWE today as Harvey Whippleman with WWE. And he's a guy that, when he first contacted me, I said, I'm just not interested. I said, I'm sorry. I said, but I'm not interested in stuff the 90s and 2000s. And he says, well, let me send you what I've written. So he sent it to me, and I was just loving it. I mean, he's hilarious. He's so funny. He tells great stories, and that's what it's all about to me. It's all about the stories and the memories and the great things that, you know, that happened on the road and what it was like to be a wrestler, even in the 90s or the 2000s, you know. I'm not interested in the the corporate type wrestlers, you know, the guys with these big contracts,
right,
just go in, you know, I have no interest in that. But the guys with the stories of the guys when they were on the road in cars and, you know, and taking train back in the 40s and 50s, they didn't even take cars. They took the train to the different towns.
Well, that's what
fascinate me.
That's what I love about the work of guys like you. Mark Hewitt does a lot of work in that similar vein. It reminds me, because Billy Robinson used to tell me, you know, it was almost like he was lamenting. He would say, you know, what you don't realize is there were so many good wrestlers that you never ever heard about. And what you're doing is a service to all those guys who have busted up their bodies, you know, lived a passion and have true stories, but they weren't these big corporate guys who had all this money to push their story into the narrative. So I'm a huge fan of what you're doing with that. Let me ask you some questions on the business, because I mean you're an expert on the history and the development of the business. When do you really think? I mean, for me personally, and you know, tell me if I'm wrong. I'm talking to you. You're the expert. I'm trying to get the record straight here for myself. I look at the last legit era of shooting. I think it kind of died. It died before Frank Gotch, for sure. I would say that maybe those last matches with Gotch and Jenkins were the last legit high-level shoot matches.
Oh, yeah, and I sort of wonder about those.
I don't think they all were. I think the early ones were when I think that, you know, Jenkins beat Gotch a couple times, and then Gotch got his number, and then I think after that, it was all about making money.
Yeah, so especially when you see these guys, you know when they start working, you know, programs, you know, they'd wrestle 1 week and 3 weeks later they'd be back in the same town or in the same area. And when you see guys that wrestled, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times in a couple months period, you know good and well those were work. But work matches went back in the 1800s. Like I said, the earliest one I've got is Omaha, Nebraska from 1887. And I got one here on my desk. It's an article from San Francisco, and it's dated August 9th, 1891 from the San Francisco Call. And the first paragraph says, about 2,000 sports paid an admission fee to witness a fake wrestling match last evening at Irving Hall between Joe Acton and Johansson, the Terrible Swede. And the funny thing about the article is, the chief, the deputy of the street department, whatever that was, he was betting on the Swede to win, and he said he didn't believe Swede that Acton could throw Swede, and the chief deputy actually put his clothes up. Now the article didn't say that it said he offered to wager his Sunday suit of clothes against a felt hat on the result. Sure enough, Swede lost, so I don't know if he actually gave up the clothes. The article didn't say whether he did, but I thought that. But that's 1891, and they're talking about 200 sports fans paid an admission fee to witness a fake wrestling match.
Yeah, I don't think it's new.
It goes way back.
I think it goes back probably thousands of years. I mean, it's not hard to figure out that you could fake a fight and sucker people into money.
That was what it was all about back then. It was about making money, betting. It wasn't about going in and a promoter paying you, you know, $500, $1,000. It was about going in there and getting people to bet their money, and then they had shills running through the crowd, betting people, you know, and then they, you know, whatever. In fact, they may even take bets all over the place, different for both guys, you know, and then whatever looks best is the one they end up putting over, you know.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, I think we're talking about how Fall Guys was really a marketing piece to benefit Toots Mont. I mean, I almost look at a lot of the Farmer Burns stuff as like the same thing with Frank Gotch, because, you know, I think he's idolized and stuff and was made such a huge star. But when you really get into the history of it, and he was Frank Kennedy, and I mean, they were hustling and swindling people, and it wasn't like... a mystery, you know, like people knew that these guys were hustlers.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. You know, that's why would why did would Frank Gotch go into an area wrestling as Ken with his last name as Kennedy unless he was trying didn't want people to know who he was? I mean, if he just going in there to wrestle, go in there as Frank Gotch, you know, but he was going in there as Jack Kennedy, hoping people would put up money to see the town local guy beat him, which, you know, people probably thought that their local guy was the best, you know, and so he'd go in there under an assumed name and then he'd beat the guy and clean up.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been so much history done on guys like that. And, you know, some of it is all in the propaganda vein, and some of these guys call themselves historians, and they're either marks or they're just, I don't know, trying to profit off that too. But I wish there was more. I love, like, the obscure guys, because I wish there's more stuff put out historically, and guys like Grubmeier, Fred Grubmeier, or even like a guy like Benny Sherman. Like, I've done so much like research trying to find anything on Benny Sherman. I can't really find anything, but he was put over so big in my personal conversations with Carl Gotch, Dick Cardinal, all these guys. Like, oh my God, Benny Sherman was just a wild man. He was so amazing, but you can't find anything because their stories are eclipsed by all this propaganda narrative stuff, you know?
That's where we go back to talking about football, you know, researching football. The stats are all there. The stories are all there, you know. They're legitimate. For pro wrestling, nobody wanted you to know about what was going on behind the scenes. They didn't want you to know about what these guys traveling around in the cars together.
Yeah.
They didn't want you to know any of this stuff, you know. And so everything was kept under the lid, you know. So there's no place to go to find out hard facts about Benny Sherman. Sure, you can find out who he wrestled, who he beat, but that's all work stuff, you know. That's all matches, you know. That's not the details behind the scenes of who, you know, his family and or how he got started and, you know, any of that stuff. You know, that just stuff's just not around. It's just not available.
Yeah, from what I understand, it seems like maybe the first two contests or first three contests between Gotch and Jenkins were legit, and then the rest of the series was just Jenkins getting old and, you know, he got swindled so many times because he couldn't read that he was just trying to make money.
Yes. And that's too about Jenkins and Gotch, you know, they're big names. You just don't know, like, these small towns when they'd have two guys, say a guy from Topeka, Kansas comes to meet a guy in Waterloo, Iowa, and they wrestle. Was that a shoot? Yet there's no way ever knowing.
Right.
You don't know, especially, like I said, if they're just local guys that, yeah, they may have been shooting because they are local guys and it wasn't like they're big names trying to draw a crowd by their name like Gotch would have. So it's just almost impossible. There's another article I have here. If you don't mind me giving this little quote.
Yeah.
It says, this is Farmer Burns and he's quitting the wrestling business. He says, there have been so many fake wrestling matches and so many men of prominence in the business have gone over the country giving what was purported to be matches for blood, but what were in reality fixed matches with an understanding of how the money was to be cut, that the people will not attend them any longer. That was Frank Burns in 1898. And what's amazing, all these articles about fake wrestling in 1800s, and yet in 1950, after or 1940, after all that went on, all those court trials with Everett Marshall, where they all exposed the business,
yeah,
what was going on in the business, in 1940, they were still making money. Yeah, the business floundered for a long time, but by the 1950s, it was picking up. And it goes right back to when I first went to a live match in Tampa, Florida. I walked in the Homer Hesterly Armory, and I heard people say, oh, you know, these matches are all fake. You know, these guys, they know who's going to win. And then the lights go out, the spotlight over the ring comes on, the guys get in the ring, start going doing their thing. And next thing you know, that same person that had been there talking about what a fake was, he's screaming himself, hoarse, kill that bum, rip. And I'll never forget the first time I heard somebody say, rip his arm off and beat him with a bloody stump. I'll never forget that. I mean, I was just brand new to it. I'd never heard anything like that. But
yeah,
that's, you know, it's funny how people, it doesn't matter what you tell them, people want to be entertained. They don't care if it's fake. Yeah, they may think it's fake or know it's fake, but they want to be entertained, and they're willing to put all their thoughts of whether or not it's real side just and become a part of it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's now, I mean, WWE is valued at $8 billion. I mean, it's unbelievable. $8 billion, and it's really, I look at the WWE as a derivative of vaudeville. I don't see it like as much different than just a continuation of vaudeville. It's just you've got theater in the round, you know.
Yeah, but you know the people. Everybody knows that it's a theater. Everybody knows it's prearranged. Everybody knows it's quote unquote sports entertainment. But you look at the match. Man, I don't watch it. I haven't watched it in really 30 years, except for a couple times. But if you turn the TV on and you see it, those people are screaming for somebody to beat the other guy. And they know good and well it's sports entertainment. But people just want to be entertained, and they want to yell and be a part of it themselves. So even with all the expose and everything being above board, everybody knowing what's what now, they still get into it just as much as they ever have.
Well, what's interesting, too, is you look at boxing, and boxing has been plagued by the exact same problems as pro wrestling. It's just like pro wrestling kind of went all in on the fakery, whereas boxing kind of is trying to keep that. Because I think what people don't realize from the sporting point of view is it only takes one person to fix a match.
Right.
And that's the guy who loses. The guy who wins may not even know. The ref may not even know.
Yeah. Oh, I could tell you stories about Frankie Kane. He was a boxer.
Yeah. I know Frankie. He's a great guy.
He did jobs. Now, you talk about a tough guy. He would go into a town for a boxing promoter, and the boxer says, "Listen, I've been building up Jake Shannon to be my top guy, and we're going to put him in a middleweight, heavyweight championship for the state next week. And I need you to go in there and make him look good and do a job and take a dive and say after 3 minutes." Well, Frankie Kane has to go in there, and not only does he have to make the guy look good, but he's got to pace himself so that he can hold the guy off.
Yeah.
But the guy he's fighting, the guy that they're putting over has no idea that they're putting him over. He doesn't know Frankie Kane's just in there to make him look good. He thinks Frankie Kane's in there to beat him. So he's trying to beat the fire out of Frankie Kane so he can knock him out. Frankie, in the meantime, is trying to work with the guy to make the guy look good, but avoid being killed in the process. Now, how do you do that? I mean, that takes a tough person.
Yeah,
yeah.
Talent. To carry the guy. I mean, and now what they do, you can see it if you're smart to the business. I mean, I'm a huge fan of UFC and mixed martial arts and grappling. And I mean, that's really what I'm trying. My little niche is I'm trying to maintain that whole shooter kind of thing, But what people still fail to realize, you look at something like UFC, you can still do works through booking. Nobody needs to know. You book a guy and you build him up on these little regional smokers, and all of a sudden he's 30-0, but he's been fighting tomato cans. And you throw him in against your champ, and the guy looks like he's amazing, but he's not. You know that he's not. You know that your champ can win or whatever. And so the work is, a lot of it these days on the shoot side is done through actually just booking guys smartly. You know what I mean? To control the book.
Absolutely. And most of them know both sides. But to get in there and work a match without your opponent knowing, your opponent's in there to kill you and you're in there working with a guy, that takes a tough guy.
Yeah, you got to definitely be a bit of a masochist if you're going to sign up for that gig.
Yep.
Well, Scott, I really, really appreciate your time. Guys, check out the Annotated Fall Guys. Go to crowbarpress.com. Also, get over to cauliflowerally.org. Support those guys. I'm not saying you have to become a lifetime member like me, but you got to get over there, and you should at least try to get to one convention. It's also great because, like Scott was saying in the first segment, there's so many vendor booths with all kinds of obscure stuff that you won't find anywhere else if you're like a true aficionado of professional wrestling. Scott, thank you so much for your time.
Jake, thank you for having me on the show, and I really appreciate it. I've had such a good time. I've really enjoyed talking with you. You're so well versed in shoot wrestling and your specific area there, and I'm amazed by your website, all the DVDs and I mean, if somebody wants to learn how to apply holds and pinning combinations, man, that's it's a place to go. I haven't really checked anything out because that's not mine, more the working. But since we've been talking, I'm going to go pick up something and see just to see what it exactly it is you do, because I think it looks great.
Oh, I appreciate it. You know, the funny thing is like there is, you know, even though there's a lot of work, there is a huge body of knowledge that is like legitimate shooting that is just absolutely fascinating. I mean, if you're into, you know, martial arts or grappling or different holds, catch wrestling, you know, there's some freaking really amazing nasty stuff that a lot of people never heard of. So, Scott, again, awesome. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can have you back on one of these days.
Oh, I'd love it. Just anytime, just let me know. I'd be more than happy. Thank you.
I'll wait like 3 weeks until your next 5 books come out, and then we can promote those.
You made my day.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Jake.
All right, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.